Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
Hey, Joe Walsh here. This immigration hell week comes to a close. Where are we? We'll talk about that when freedom returns at 5.
Good morning. That's a great question. Where are we? 312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment. Good Friday morning. Amy Jacobson here. Dan Proft on his way in. Apparently he overslept, allegedly. We'll get the real story. But
he overgolfed.
Oh, that's right.
He overgolfed.
Yeah. Well, a lot of news to cover this morning. Of course, the passing of Charles Krauthammer. And we will get to that in the fine career and the legacy that he leaves behind. Mm-hmm. Died at the age of 68. But start with Melania Trump, because she made a surprise visit. We learned yesterday morning that she secretly got out of the White House, got onto Air Force One, and traveled to a shelter in outside of McAllen, Texas, where she offered her support and her love.
We all know they're here without their families. And I want to thank you for your hard work, your compassion, and your kindness you're giving them in these difficult times. I'm here to learn about your facility, and which I know you house children on a long-term basis. And I also like to ask you how I can help.
So she offered her, you know, her help, what she could do. She did a quick tour of the facility. That's where they house 12 to 17-year-olds, and 10% of them have been or are going to be reunited with their parents. The main goal here is to get families that are separated back together. We know of the 2,300 children, 500 have been reunited with their family, including that Guatemalan woman who sued the Trump administration because they took her son away. Last night, she was reunited with her son and deported back to Guatemala. But the big story this morning, what kind of took away from her lovely efforts to be with the children and to support the children, is when she got on to Air Force One, she had on a jacket that surprised me. It was an Army green jacket, and on the back it read, "I really don't care, do you?" in big white graffiti-like letters. It's kind of strange, considering the firestorm over separating migrant children from their families. The coat was from last year's. It's a Zara. Do you have that brand? Zara. I've never heard of Zara.
All over my house. I am such a fan of that brand, and I just can't tell you. I've been lavishing it on my wife and my daughter for years now, and in fact, I have some in my closet, too.
I'm sure you do. Yes. You wore your Zara today. But
yes,
this is a billion-dollar model who puts on a $39 jacket from last year and says that there's no message. Everyone's watching her, and she has on the back, "I really don't care, do you?" What message was she sending? What was she talking about? Immigration? Was she talking about the media? Was she talking about her recent kidney procedure?
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the reporters were hounding on her, like, what really happened? Because it was a 3 to 4 hour kidney operation that she had.
Mm-hmm.
So 312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 64636 turnkey.pro answer or text line. Because I've been fiercely, fiercely protective of Melania Trump. I think she's a beautiful woman. She's doing an excellent job. But why wear that coat? The whole world was watching her. And her spokesperson said, Stephanie Grissom, I butchered that name, said there's no hidden message in the jacket, and I hope that the media isn't going to choose to focus on her wardrobe.
I think the message was very typical from a very media-centric first family that does nothing without thinking or trying to appropriate the 24/7 news cycle. It's very easily, I think, determined that someone said, "Hey, wear this because it will cause buzz and controversy." and will bring us to the top of the news cycle, and also will raise awareness to the issue, which is ancillary to the fact that you're raising the name Trump in an election year, in a mid-year. Everything this White House does is media-focused, media-centric, even the First Lady.
I was hoping that it was a coincidence.
So I don't think it is.
I think it's bunched up in back, where I thought there was some Arabic writing on her back, because it's graffiti-type letter, but it was scrunched in. So I don't even know if she realized what she was doing when she was wearing that jacket. And it's really hot in Texas. I don't think you need a jacket anyway. But when she landed in McAllen, Texas, the jacket was gone.
Yeah, I think, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I'm just saying everything that this White House does is calculated and is for effect and for maximum effort. And we should be used to this by now. We went through the 8 years of the Obama administration where everything was calculated for maximum media effect, and we can't expect anything else out of the White House. This is the new...
Michelle Obama would have never worn a jacket like that. Laura Bush would have never. Hillary Clinton couldn't put that on her pantsuit.
Michelle Obama would have used words, not a jacket.
Yeah, but why would you even say, when you're going to see children who are so distraught, most of them have been separated from their parents, don't know where their parents are. I really don't care, do you?
I think everything is calculated for maximum effect. I think it's a simple matter of, hey, wear that jacket. It'll cause buzz. It wasn't designed to be. If it was designed to cause controversy, it was politically designed by President Trump's people to be a middle finger at the media. That's really all I'm going to put into it right now. And anything more than that is probably stepping into deep water.
According to CNN, she insisted, even before her husband signed the executive order, she went to him and said, tomorrow morning, I'm going to one of those shelters.
It's possible, yeah.
Yeah, no, CNN reported that, ABC News, that she was insistent that she goes. Other publications were saying that she went for damage control. I don't think she was going for damage control.
No,
I just think she's a compassionate person, and she just wanted to see how these shelters were being run. And if you look at all the video of the kids, there's kids in 17 different states.
Mm-hmm.
They have, just because, you know, I've volunteered at schools, and I used to be a substitute teacher, those kids have nice shoes, nice clothes, the finest of backpacks. I mean, they're being, you know, we don't see their faces, but then you see, you know, the food that they're eating, and we are providing for them. So if anybody thinks we're not providing for them, shame on them. 312-642-5600 is our Turnkey DepPro answer line. Let's go to Chris, who joins us from Aurora. Good morning, Chris.
Okay, I'm going to try to lay this out very good and prosecute this case right here, one try.
Help me out.
Okay, you need to be able to stand on this foundation. Do you believe she cares about those kids, yes or no?
Oh, completely I do.
Okay, so do I. So we're going to stand on that foundation, and we're not going to be wavered. So she's been in the White House right after her surgery. 2 days ago, Peter Fonda is saying stuff about her kid putting him in cages with a pedophile. She can't come out right, just like any normal person, and fire back, because she's the First Lady. So she wears this jacket, and as far as anybody is concerned about, it was bad timing, you shouldn't have did it in this format, or no. This is her firing back, because this is the first time she came out of the White House. It's about Peter Fonda, and has nothing to do with the immigration thing, because we all believe she truly cares about those kids.
All right.
Case over.
Thanks, Chris. Let's go to Roosevelt, who joins us from Midway. Good morning, Roosevelt.
Good morning, guys. How are you doing this morning?
Good. How are you?
Excellent.
Fantastic. I think I call it the dog whistle cult. And I also look at it the other way. She's used to wearing the best things in as far as a model. She was a model, right? First lady. And she picks a coat that's $39. Also, I don't remember seeing her with any wardrobe, with any writing. Any pictures, videos. So out of all the things in her wardrobe, she wears something with writing, and specifically something that says, I don't care, do you? And she goes to a place where she's supposed to show, as a first lady, that she cares. I think it's a dog whistle cult for her husband's base. Raw meat.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he might have something there. Again, it goes back to the White House.
She's better than that.
I think she is. But remember, it's maximum political effect news cycle. The Trump administration. Trump administration learned that from previous administrations, and they're using it to maximum effect.
Yep.
All right. Thanks, Roosevelt, for the call. Let's go to Debbie, who joins us from Schaumburg. Good morning, Debbie.
Good morning, guys. I have to agree. I think it is a middle finger to the media. They've been terribly abusive to her, bullying her, accusing her of being a victim of a physical abuse from her husband, threatening to take her child away, making fun of her accent, and all of the media bullying her and not being proactive and going down there themselves to see what's going on and actually possibly lending a helping hand. And I am with her all the way in this president. That's all I have to say.
All right. Thank you, Debbie. I just wanted her to bring back the heels. You know, where are those 5-inch stilettos? And maybe she could have read Party Animals.
Party Animals.
All right. Let's go to Paul, who joins us from New Lenox. Good morning, Paul.
I think Lonnie's got so much poise that the jacket she wore was a rebuttal to saying that she does really care and doesn't give the media a chance to come back and say that Trumps don't really care, because she was one of the ones who kind of persuaded Donald to pass that executive order. And that's all. I agree with the other callers on that, so... I don't think it's a big political statement. It's her way of just being poised in the first lady and saying, hey, I'm here. I really do care. So whatever you read into it, doesn't matter.
All right.
Great show again.
Thanks, Paul. John has a very interesting take on this. John joins us from Palatine.
Hi. Good morning. I wonder if she was set up. Yeah, apparently she told her husband that she was going to do this. He may have been a little bit perturbed. She took it upon herself, and so someone kindly found a jacket for her to wear with the message. And she didn't wear it, apparently, when she got off the plane. So if it was so important to her, why didn't she keep it on?
Yeah, that's a good point. Also, too, it was scrunched up in the back, so you couldn't read it. What they had to do is take, you know, something off the internet of that jacket and the style, and that's when you could see, I really don't care, do you? Quickly, let's go to David, who joins us from beautiful McCook. Good morning, David.
Lovely McCook. Happy Friday, guys.
Thanks.
The new catchphrase from the left is the word outrage. 50% of the articles I read on the news, everybody from the left is outraged over things that most of us could care less about. So I'm just waiting to see a news article that somebody was outraged over Melania Trump's jacket.
All right. Thanks so much, David. All I know is that when I saw her in McAllen, Texas, at that shelter, I knew she was going to make everything better.
These children, most of them come here alone, without parents.
The majority of our children.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And yes, I am wearing Zara today.
I knew you would be. You're so fashionable. You're so fashion forward because whatever is old is new.
Try to be au courant.
Yeah.
Like Melania. And just because I, too, was a high-end fashion model in my day doesn't mean that I can't wear things that are not opulent, but that are, you know, keeping with current trends.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Zara, good luck trying to find a Zara jacket. They're selling like hotcakes.
Yeah, let me ask you this question, though. Are you buying the rhetoric that... both the Democrats as well as Speaker Ryan and the Republicans are selling? Does anything that has happened this week with our hyper-focus on immigration and the family separation policy and sort of relitigating the larger debates about immigration reform, do you sense that there has been any movement? Has anybody on either side, to the extent there are only two sides, I think there's more than that, but has anybody in the public eye, anybody in a public policymaking position, said anything different that you think advances the flag, including the president, other than by executive order allegedly eliminating the family separation policy, which is nothing more than reverting back to the catch and release?
And
but one could argue that's a change. I would argue it's not. Has anything changed? All of the sob stories, all of the histrionics,
all of the partisan back and forth, even the infighting in the House Republican caucus after the Goodlatte bill went down yesterday and the Ryan back bill postponed for a vote until next week.
That happened, and no Democrats voted. So that didn't advance anything, and they're kicking the can down the road by voting next week.
So has anybody said or done anything interesting from your perspective to advance the flag this week? 312-642-5600, Turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, Turnkey.pro text line.
President Trump agreed with you, what you said yesterday about this executive order, about separating families and trying not to have that happen.
Democrat and court-ordered loopholes prevent family detention and lead to family separation, no matter how you cut it. I signed a very good executive order yesterday, but that's only limited. No matter how you cut it, it leads to separation ultimately.
The only person, I'll be the first to offer an answer to my own question.
Okay, yes.
The only person who's done something new this week that I think probably solves the problem.
Yeah?
As usual.
Who?
Alyssa Milano. There she goes again, solving public policy problems. She moved by the images and stories, whether they're fact-based or not, of children and foster care facilities in Harlem separated from their parents that she has offered.
Her home in Malibu?
I think her home in New York.
Or
that'd be a tough commute for the kids in Harlem. I will register with the appropriate authorities so I can bring some of these children into my home and foster them during this time of need. Afterwards, I will help ensure that they get the help they need to fight their cases, stay, and win. I'm sure this is something many Americans, other Americans, would consider as a moral and patriotic duty as well. Well, great. There's
has she filled out the paperwork and had the interview process to be a foster mom? It's not that easy.
You know, I haven't had a chance to follow up with her on this.
Uh-huh. Does she have a man, a husband in her life? I mean, is it?
But she's looking at about making space for about 350 migrant children at this point if she's going to keep it local. But at least she's doing something in furtherance with who she says she is and what she says she believes. At least she ostensibly is. And this is why I hope that the Ivy League and Champagne Socialists all over the place, including up here in Chicago's North Shore, that would applaud her, that take the same position she does, that take the same antagonism that she does against the Trump administration, the enforcement of law, border security. I would hope that they would go ahead and be the change like Alyssa Milano is. So she's the only one so far that I've found this week to be saying or doing anything different that is of a substantive nature.
Just got a text message saying, yes, the left should open up their homes to all of these people, all these children.
And again, I mean, they are opening campuses.
Yeah, and
college campuses, the perfect place to start.
Especially, too, during the summertime when some of the college campuses, the sororities, fraternities are closed down, they can house people there. I mean, if these lefty liberals have such a loving heart, open up your doors.
Well, here's what those in public policy positions had to say. Paul Ryan at his presser yesterday talking about this ridiculous choice that the president is presented with at this point, and thus the need for congressional action, including a congressional family separation fix.
The law should not have our government choose between enforcing our borders, enforcing our laws, securing our borders, and keeping families together. That's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous choice. Tomorrow, we're going to have a vote on legislation that makes sure that we can enforce our laws and keep families together.
All right, so that's his rhetorical position. We haven't seen anything advanced, successfully advanced to this point in furtherance of that. Now, on the other side, you had Nancy Pelosi, who was asked about border security, border wall in particular.
Uh-oh, did you know what that is?
Remember the whole kumbaya bipartisan roundtable meeting they had with President Trump?
Oh, yeah.
Where people like Steny Hoyer were adamant that they're for border security. Right? We have to, you know, move in the direction of perhaps reforming some of the criteria that we use to make decisions on who can come in and on what timeline. But hey, make no mistake about it. The Democrats are serious about border security, about ejecting violent criminals who are here illegally. Very serious about that.
Would it be better to build a wall at the border?
No, it would not be better to build a wall. A wall is ineffective, expensive, immoral, and where there might be some places where it's useful from a security and a...
What's the word?
Mutually agreed upon protection for each side to have some structure. Let's see what that is. But it's not better to build a wall. What's better to do is to build a bridge.
Build a bridge.
All right. Who supports funding for building a bridge on the border? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line. This way you don't have to swim over.
Oh, that's right. You can you just don't have walk to... across the bridge.
Yeah. Let's make it nice and orderly. No wall, no border security, just a bridge. It's not three strikes and you're out. It's four balls and you're on, to invoke a great Jesse Jackson senior-ism.
Four balls and you're on?
Hey, ask him. I have no idea what he's
talking
about.
The only progress that was made from yesterday to today to this morning is of the 2,300 children who have been separated from their parents, 500 have so far been reunited and taken back.
No, it's great. It's fantastic. We have audio of one of those reunions, but then a bit of a goodbye when.
Oh, is this going to make me cry?
Well, when there's an alien separation, it's difficult.
I'll be right here.
First time I bawled in a movie.
So, I mean, in a sense, there is no separation because it's here. You're united here. Okay, and also the other issue of du jour with respect to immigration this week, of course, is who can be more morally indignant, who can be more outraged with respect to this policy, and most notably with respect to this president. And so it was fun to see Senator Tammy Baldwin. She's just north of the Cheese Curtain here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, she's in Wisconsin. She's facing a reelection fight that I'm certainly rooting for her to lose. And to her credit, you might want to mark this down, time code this, because this is not something you're going to hear me say very often because it's not warranted.
What?
To her credit, Brooke Baldwin at CNN.
Oh, who cried yesterday, too, by the way.
Well, she was able.
She got teary-eyed. And
she was able to dry
herself.
She was able to compose herself and dry her tears long enough to put it to Tammy Baldwin. What about when this was happening? You know, with the previous guy.
They should have done more, right? And so, as so many people in this country are certainly outraged by the cages and the thermal blankets and the facilities housing these kids, you know, they were all there in 2014 under President Obama. And my question to you, Senator Baldwin, is did you speak up against them then?
You know, on this issue that we get into a moment where we're making progress and then when it stalls, we turn around. I think we all need to continue to be focused on it and press it through. The American people need confidence that we can solve problems. Nobody believes that we have an immigration system that works. Yeah. It is broken. It needs fixing. But we've just got to resolve to do that.
But were you worried about it then? Did you raise your voice under the Obama administration?
You know, in numbers of cases, usually I remember a constituent who was in detention at the border, arguably very inappropriately. And we, you know, we raised our voice in that instance and many others. But that's, we've got to do this now in unison. It's not enough to do it case by case. Or senator or house member by house member.
That
We've
is
got to that resolve is, to fix this issue.
What in God's name is that woman talking about?
That is a convoluted way of trying to walk around the fact that, no, of course she didn't express outrage when the same policy was occurring under the Obama administration. And, yes, she was surprised by the question. And, yes, she was trying to bail water. And, no, she's not quick on her feet. And yes, she should be de-elected.
Exactly. President Trump, though, defended. He had a quick White House briefing where they let him into the conference room and he talked about zero tolerance.
If we took zero tolerance away, you would be overrun
as a country. You'd have millions of people pouring through our border.
And listen.
They walk through Mexico like it's walking through Central Park.
Because he blamed Mexico for not doing enough.
They don't care about the children. They don't care about the injury. They don't care about the problems. They don't care about anything.
Yeah, well, there is some truth to what he's saying with respect to, say, unaccompanied minors, 17 years or younger, that so many people have found newfound concern over. Fiscal year 2017, the federal government puts the number at 41,456 unaccompanied minors, 17 or younger, who crossed the border into this country. So,
or are they going to set up shop and then eventually bring mom and dad over? Or they just wanted to
Runaways? I'm less interested in what they want to do. What I'm interested in is all the people with the hand-wringing and the preening and the crocodile tears. What do you got to say? What do you want to do? You agree with Pelosi? You agree with President Trump and Speaker Ryan about the need for a third option for the President of the United States? You know, spare me... You know, the pantomiming, the bleeding, and tell me what you want to do.
312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Because there's a recognition that this week has provided optics problems. Even Jeff Sessions, who sat down to be interviewed by David Brody on the Christian Broadcasting Network, conceded that.
The media narrative out there has been that the Trump administration caving to pressure, that these optics have not been good for the administration. What's the response to that?
Well, it hasn't been good. And the American people don't like the idea that we're separating families. We never really intended to do that. What we intended to do was to make sure that adults who bring children into the country are charged with the crime they've committed, instead of giving that special group of adults immunity from prosecution, which is what, in effect, we were doing. So I think it's the right thing. We'll work our way through it and try to do it in the most compassionate way possible.
If Republicans can not completely come apart at the seam on Capitol Hill, there's a real opportunity here, and even the left understands it. Some on the left do. A piece in The Atlantic about the lesson Democrats have yet to learn on immigration. And remember, they're rooting for the Democrats. The vast majority of Americans oppose Trump's policy with respect to this family separation that has been ongoing. Not that it's Trump's policy, the policy inherited, but nevertheless, this is their rhetoric. But it doesn't mean that they're willing to hand over control of the border to Democrats. The problem is, as strange as it might seem to immigration progressives, many Americans, enough to swing elections, might regard Democrats as just as extreme as Trump. And he goes through the level of support there is for the sort of four pillars of immigration reform when it comes to the system writ large that Trump has proposed. So the open borders Democrats that Trump has been pillaring since his rally in Duluth this week, there's a... You know, that's a good political position to take. That doesn't mean that Republicans are absolved of their dimwittery and their cowardice on this issue. But in terms of kind of the binary that you have of Republican leadership or Democrat leadership, Republican congressional candidates, Democrat congressional candidates, they might not like what they've seen. The American people might not like what they've seen on TV this week and the flames that have been fanned by the press. But they're not signing up for the open borders team either.
No. And President Trump just tweeted, Republicans should stop wasting their time on immigration until after we elect more senators and congressmen and women in November. Dems are just playing games. They have no intention of doing anything to solve this decades old problem. We can pass great legislation after the red wave. Exclamation point. Good point.
It's a good little piece of jujitsu by Trump staying on offense. I agree with that. George in Elk Grove Village. George.
What is he listening
Hello.
To?
George, yes, please.
Come
back to this universe, yes.
Hello.
Yeah, George, it's Dan and Amy. You called us. You're on now.
Oh, I did. I was just listening on my phone.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, I had a comment on the bridge. I think you should just build a big U-turn bridge where the entrance and the exit are both in Mexico.
Okay. All right. Thanks for
the call, George. See in the sky deck there?
We are used to building bridges to nowhere in this country.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy talking about immigration and this week's drama and melodrama. Mike on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi. What I think we should do is have a tax and tariff on all aliens that come in through Mexico from South America, and if they cross illegally, all that's doubled, and it's payable by Mexico. And if we're going to build the bridge, we'll build half of it after we put up the wall.
A bridge to a wall. There you go. All right. Thanks for the call, Mike. Speaking of this whole topic, Ari Melania going down to McAllen, Texas yesterday and the controversy over that coat, did you see Bulls' first pick overall?
Wendell Carter Jr.? First
round draft pick, yeah.
From Duke. Yeah, he was wearing a Black Panther-inspired ensemble that he and his mom and dad decided to all...
Well, it was a Gucci scarf.
It was a Gucci scarf, but then she had that, and then his dad had his suit coat. He had the Gucci scarf sewn into the jacket. The mom had the Gucci scarf sewn into her dress.
What kind of statement were they making about immigration?
I don't know.
With that scarf, do you
Printed
think?
Printed tiger? I don't know. They're promoting the Black Panther movie and what it meant to be a black superhero.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that he thinks highly of himself?
Do you think?
I was just wondering, because I'm watching the video that his family produced about his greatness.
Well, I'm wondering who actually had the most serious fashion emergency yesterday. Was it Wendell Carter Jr. or Melania?
I think Trae Young had the worst fashion emergency of the night. Much worse than both of those two. Wendell looked good. Wendell looked very good. Did you see Trae Young?
Trae Young is the best shooter in the draft. So
Trae Young was wearing wore shorts to the draft last night.
Well, that's because LeBron James started that. I know.
Trae Young wore shorts to the draft last night.
That's LeBron's fault. That is LeBron's fault.
That is LeBron's fault.
He should have got drafted by the Bulls. Actually, the Bulls with Wendell Carter Jr. and Chandler Hutchison from Boise State had a good first round.
They did.
That was a good draft.
All right.
All right.
You're saying something positive about the Bulls. Wow.
Fred Hoiberg may not have to suit up this year.
Exactly.
The mayor.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
If you're talking about it, I'll be talking about it. Dennis Prager here. Join me this morning at 11 right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Hey, it's impeachment day. It's impeachment day. Isn't it? Isn't that what Devin Nunez sort of intimated and Trey Gowdy sort of echoed? Hey, if Rod Rosenstein, you dudes, and you, Christopher Wray, you were at that meeting last Friday. You heard what Speaker Ryan said. You don't produce those documents, then you don't got no job.
Oh, that's right.
So today's the day, the deadline, according to what the House Intel and House Oversight Chairman have said during the week. And actually, Nunez said they better start producing documents by midweek or we're going to have a problem. I suppose this immigration dust-up has derailed that, at least from leading the news. But we are on the clock, according to House Republicans. We've been talking about the Inspector General's report all week, as well as this meeting that happened last Friday, as I just described. We continue to get more information. Christopher Steele. Key of the Steele dossier, according to State Department logs, visited the State Department to brief officials on the dossier in October of 2016. That's according to information obtained by the chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, Richard Burr. He also revealed Steele's visit during visit during an exchange with Victoria Nuland, who served as Assistant Secretary of State for Europe and Eurasian Affairs in the Obama administration. And the drip, drip, drip. The same thing happened when Horowitz, the Inspector General, was before the House, and Jim Jordan was asking him about the Strzok email, sort of the Strzok smoking gun email, if you will. No matter how you want to interpret it, it was new information, text messages, email, text messages, that, we're going to stop him.
Right.
well, if you referred that to Rod Rosenstein a month ago, why did Congress only get it last week? Was Jim Jordan's question to Horowitz. Not, again, exactly inspiring trust between the legislative branch and the Department of Justice. So we poured over the details, but you know, what do I know? I didn't even sit for the bar. Let's get the opinion of an expert who's been covering this as closely as anyone in the country. He's former federal prosecutor and a contributing editor to National Review, Andy McCarthy. Andy, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Dan, it's my pleasure. Going to law school only screws up your brain. So
I did go to law school.
Yeah, he did go.
Yeah.
Just
all right, so that explains a lot then.
It really does.
Do you regret you didn't see it through?
I did. Well, I did. I finished law school. I just didn't sit for the bar because I didn't want to be tempted into the practice of law. I wasn't strong enough to resist, so I just knocked myself out of the box, I think.
My mom made me hang in because she said I needed to know how the enemy thinks.
There you go. It is actually a great education and training. But I digress. So you have suggested that based on this Horowitz Inspector General report that we've been talking about the last week, it's time to button up the Mueller obstruction investigation and call it a day.
Yeah, well, I don't see how the Justice Department can continue with it, at least as a serious piece of criminal investigation. If the position that they're taking, and it's clear that they have accepted and endorsed Horowitz's report, the IG's theory here is that even though there was rampant evidence of bias, he not only can't make a conclusion that any particular action was driven by bias, but what he says is that because the FBI has very broad investigative discretion, they have broad authority to make decisions in the areas like what investigative techniques to use and whether people should be charged or not. What he says is that if there are two competing potential interpretations of why they did what they did, and one of them is a potentially corrupt interpretation, and the other one is a legitimate interpretation because the action can arguably be supported by legitimate government policies, then he has to assume that it was done for legitimate purposes. So if that's their view of the world, I don't see how you investigate Trump for firing the FBI director or weighing in on Mike Flynn's potential investigation by the FBI, since those are clearly things that the president in his constitutional prerogative is permitted to do. In fact, the president has much broader discretion than the FBI does. The FBI is a creature of statute, and a lot of its activities are controlled by statute and limited by statute. The president has broad constitutional authority. And the evidence that the president had corrupt motives in the actions that he took is minimal compared to the evidence of rampant bias at the FBI. So I just don't see how you continue the obstruction investigation.
Well, we've learned through these hearings, you know, that McCabe lied under oath. Comey gave some what might be classified or unclassified information to one of his former professors. Do you trust the Inspector General, Michael Horowitz?
Do I trust him?
Yes. Do you think he's a decent human being?
Well, yeah, I do. I mean, I know him from the U.S. Attorney's Office. I overlapped with him for a number of years. He's a straight shooter. He's a very good prosecutor. I think this report demonstrates that he had a lot of attention to detail in unearthing a lot of facts that we didn't know before. Mm-hmm. Where I part company with him, you know, the fact that I trust him doesn't mean I agree with him on everything. And where I part company with him is he has a very small target or a very limited idea of what his role is here. So what he says basically is if people are acting in a way that is arguably consistent with government policies, I can't make a conclusion that anybody was driven by bias, even though there's pervasive evidence of bias. And I think, you know, your common sense, you know, to go back to what Dan was saying earlier about, you know, lawyers and non-lawyers, you know, take your lawyer hat off for a second and just have your person hat on. If a person is, if they show that an institution has pervasive bias and then they take actions in a way that's completely consistent with the bias, common sense says that you can conclude that bias factored into the decision making. Doesn't mean it was the only factor, but to say that it was not relevant. I mean, can you imagine if you had a jury? Let's put the FBI aside. A guy gets convicted in a jury trial, and we find out later that the jurors had the same kind of attitudes about the person who was accused as the FBI had with respect to Trump. I think that 10 out of 10 people would say that wasn't a fair trial.
So let me ask you this, though, where Horowitz did come down and make explicit he believes Andy McCabe, former deputy FBI director, lied under oath. That's a problem. Yeah. He also suggested that Jim Comey's actions with respect to classified information are under investigation. At what point, if you're President Trump, do you intervene with respect to Rod Rosenstein if, as you suggest, he allows Mueller to continue his fishing expedition unencumbered? And number two, he ignores criminal referrals from the Inspector General's report with respect to senior level officials at FBI, for example.
Well, let's take the second one first, because I think that's the easy one. So far, as I understand it, the Justice Department has not ignored any referrals from the IG. That doesn't mean you'll see immediate action on them, but I don't think they're ignoring them. On the flip side of that, I think a lot, much too much is being made of the fact that they've opened an investigation on Jim Comey. Now, it may very well be that, you know, they're going to conduct this investigation. He certainly has a problem because there's classified information in these memos that he caused the leaking of. So that's clearly something that's going to be looked into. At the same time, I think what people need to realize is that the Congress referred this to the Justice Department for prosecution, and the Justice Department gave it to the IG. They didn't give it to a federal prosecutor. They gave it to the Inspector General, who's not in a position to prosecute. So the Inspector General will run it down and develop the facts. But I think if they thought there was smoking gun criminal liability here, this is not how they would have referred it. It would have gone to a U.S. attorney's office rather than the IG. So I think we just need to take a deep breath and see how that plays itself out. as far as concerns, you know, Rosenstein at the Justice Department and the FBI's intransigence with respect to request by the Congress, I think that, you know, the elephant in the room here is that President Trump has the complete authority to direct Rosenstein and Ray to cooperate with Congress. And I, for the life of me, continue, other than to see a political dimension to this, I cannot understand why the Republicans in the House who have been agitating over this, and I support them in their agitation because I think this has to get to the bottom. We have to get to the bottom of this. But they're making this like this is a Rosenstein and Ray problem. And the fact of the matter is, if the Democrats were in power and we had a similar situation, they would be saying, where's the president? You know, it's the president's obligation. The president runs the executive branch. Why isn't the president pressuring or ordering his subordinates to cooperate with a congressional investigation? Well, and I think it's a pertinent question.
And obviously there are political calculations in every direction here. Maybe he thinks like he's winning. He doesn't want to change anything. And you've got more Inspector General reports that are forthcoming from Horowitz, including on the start of the Trump investigation, this now Comey investigation, whether there's something there or not. It is a cloud that overhangs the whole investigation and serves to further damage its credibility. So we'll just do another couple of years of Horowitz putting together these devastating reports. We'll do the politics of it. And if you want to continue on, you continue on, and I'm going to do my other business.
Yeah, well, call me old-fashioned. But I think that if we have a problem in an institution which is as important to the country in terms of the rule of law and our national prosperity as the FBI and the Justice Department are, then finding out what happened here is more important than anybody's political calculation about whether they're winning on it or not. And if you decide to elevate the politics of it over the policy of it, then I think people like me start to say, well, maybe this isn't so important anyway.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I agree with that. You think not only should Trump provide that direction you've described, also his powers to declassify information, make it publicly available, which you've written about. But what about actually getting more actively and very publicly involved after Jim Jordan's recitation of what's happened to the senior leadership of the FBI over the last year, which is rather incredible to the context he put it, all these six people that are been demoted, dismissed, and discredited. Trump getting and saying, hey, Christopher Wray, Jeff Sessions, Rod Rosenstein, I'm going to get involved and we're going to clean up and rebuild the credibility of these institutions, or I'm going to get some buddies who will.
Yeah, I'm about 90% of the way there. My sympathy for the president in this regard is that he has such a thin margin in the Senate that, you know, for all the people who say, well, why doesn't he just fire Rosenstein or why doesn't he just fire Sessions? Well, you know, who replaces them? Mm-hmm. If you think about where we are at the Justice Department, we're going in the wrong direction. I mean, if you remember about a year ago, maybe a little more than that, he had four big appointees at the Justice Department. He had Sessions, Rosenstein, Rachel Brand was there in the number three slot, and Francisco was there as the Solicitor General. Rachel Brand is gone, and they haven't replaced her. So, you know, if you move out the very few Trump appointees that are in the Justice Department, who's going to run the Justice Department? For all the people who complain about the Obama carryover people, that's who's going to be running the Justice Department. Who do you think advised Sessions that he had to recuse himself at the time when Sessions was the only Trump appointee at the Justice Department?
Mm-hmm.
It was the Obama mm-hmm. people. So,
yeah.
You know, it's easy to say these people need to be swept out because they're not doing a great job, but Trump has to then deal with, well, what comes after them.
Senate
right now,
right.
He may think that having Rosenstein there is better than the alternative.
He is Andy McCarthy, former Chief Assistant U.S. Attorney in Manhattan, a contributing editor to National Review, one of the definitive voices on all things Russian collusion investigation related. Andy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks. Have a great weekend.
You too.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Who should replace Roseanne in the Connors spinoff of Roseanne? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Who should replace Roseanne, who will not be part of that spinoff because ABC wants to make money, but they don't want to take heat, so they got to get rid of Roseanne. But can they make money if they don't have Roseanne?
Whoa. Yeah, they officially announced their spinoff for Roseanne. There's going to be 10 episodes of the show, and it's going to be called The Connors. That's what they're thinking it's going to be called. So
my suggestion,
yeah,
to replace Roseanne. Let's get it going.
All right, 312-642-5600. Creative juices going on this soggy Friday.
I have two thoughts.
Yes.
One, Valerie Jarrett, obviously.
No brainer, yeah.
The other would be John Goodman in both roles.
Oh.
John Goodman could, I mean, he just looks like a bigger version of Roseanne.
Mm-hmm.
So he could easily play both roles.
The new take, which will also be a multi-camera comedy and premiere in the fall.
Are you a producer on the show or something?
Follow the Connor family, who, after a sudden turn of events, are forced to face the daily struggles of life. I love Roseanne, the reboot of Roseanne. I actually watch the episodes over and over again.
Yeah, I know.
Because it's a great,
sad
but,
life.
But also, too, how are they? Are they going to kill her off? Because in the last episode, last few episodes of this first reboot season, she became addicted to prescription medicine because she has a bad knee, don't you know? And she's going to be going to have surgery. So the question is, does she die on the surgical table? Is she in rehab? I mean, what are they going to do with her character? Are they going to completely kill her off or just, you know, because they have to address the elephant in the room.
Literally.
Where's mom?
She's probably maybe beaten to death on a college campus by a bunch of social justice warriors.
Maybe her sister who wears a pea hat and then, you know, the T-shirt. Maybe she'll get into a fist fight with her and get out the shank, kill her.
So they're
possibly
coming. The rest of the cast is coming back. Mm-hmm. And then all those jobs that everybody was afraid were going to be lost forever. The key grips are going to be employed again.
Well, the cast and crew. I mean, there's 212 mm-hmm. people who counted on that second season, and then now they will have a job.
Oh, it's fantastic.
Makeup artists, you know, set designers, all of that.
48% of registered voters, according to Quinnipiac's survey, agreed with ABC's decision to cancel the show. 34% said they would like to see it remain on the air. Among those identified as Republicans, a little higher, 50% disagreed with the network's move. So it was a plurality of Americans who weighed in on this because we like to weigh in on celebrity nonsense rather than
But it was a show where it was okay to be a Trump supporter, and she had great dialogue and great exchanges with her sister, who is a flaming liberal, and I loved it because they actually, at the beginning, it was, you know, they were very confrontational, then they learned how to joke around with each other politically, and it's just, I thought it was brilliant.
So it sounds very intellectually robust.
It's not intellectually robust. It's just very street, and it's very blue collar, and it's very much reflective of reality right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How do you think they're going to...
So who should replace her?
Who should replace Roseanne? Well, yeah, because obviously he's going to start dating again, so we're going to have to go through...
I don't think there's anything obvious
Paula
about
Poundstone.
John Goodman dating again. Paula Poundstone. Was she on the other one?
I think she maybe...
Before she kidnapped a kid?
You know, those charges were dropped. Oh. But this thing called 9/11 happened that day, so no one ever heard the rest of her story.
Uh-huh. Okay. Don't want to go down that rabbit hole.
Who should replace Roseanne Barr? 312-642-5600.
Mark and Valpo.
Yeah, I think you should use Rosie O'Donnell or Michael Moore.
Michael Moore would be good. I would go with Michael Moore. Thanks for the call, Mark. I think Michael Moore would be a good replacement.
Michael Moore? Oh, yeah. That's good. Rosie O'Donnell's pretty good, too, because she's out of work. So
Michael Moore's a better actress. Megan and Wilmette, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
He just stole my thunder. I was going to say Michael Moore. He looks just like her.
Yeah. Boy, I don't know how we missed that. Thanks for the call, Megan.
Oh.
Michael Moore. We got Michael Moore. We got Valerie Jarrett, who also bears a striking resemblance.
Uh-huh.
And then John Goodman in both roles so far.
What about Kirstie Alley? She's kind of...
Where is she? Is she?
She's alive.
No, but where is she
on the weight scale?
Yeah, of course.
Because then you fat, skinny, fat. I think she's back up. She's not doing those commercials anymore.
What about Hillary?
Oh. No.
It wouldn't work?
No, I can't see her and John Goodman together. Because there are a lot of bed scenes on Roseanne when he puts on his CPAP thing.
Ooh.
For snoring.
All right. Sorry, scrap that. Todd in Harvard, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
J.B. Pritzker.
J.B. Pritzker's a good call. Thanks for the call, Todd. J.B. Pritzker, yeah. That would be the music that follows him around.
J.B. Pritzker.
He'd probably have a Family Guy trademark infringement suit. But could he? I guess, I mean, he just wants to wear the Mayor Quimby sash. Governor sash, just like Ronner did. So I guess he could be governor and star in a sitcom. You're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
You,
anonymous. Yes.
This is Jerry.
Oh, hey, Jerry.
Lisa Lampanelli.
Ooh, the Queen of Mean, yeah. Oh, thanks for the
Isn't
call.
Isn't she doing those diaper commercials now?
What?
Lisa Lampanelli?
Do you know who she is?
She's got the big lips, right?
Dude, what does she do?
She's an actress.
No.
Oh, then I don't know.
Correct, you don't.
Well, educate me.
She's a comedian.
Oh.
She's sort of a comedian, excuse me. She's a sort of a foul mouth. She's like Andrew Dice Clay, but in a, you know, in a dress, sort of. Yeah,
oh,
she's.
You know what? You could bring Kathy Griffin in.
She works blue. No, I don't. Yeah.
To be the new love interest?
No.
Of...
You got to have somebody that fills Roseanne's comfortable shoes. I don't know.
There's only one Roseanne. I mean, Rosie O'Donnell would be perfect.
No.
They even look the same, they look alike.
Michael Moore. J.B. Pritzker, John Goodman, Valerie Jarrett. I would say that'd be the short list. We should have them all come in for a reading. Then we can make a recommendation to ABC.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Music,
oh, I love it.
The show's terrible. So replacing Roseanne, that's what we're talking about. We're actually getting some serious casting suggestions, as well as rounding out the cast.
From your father. What did your dad say?
I'll get to that. One text, rounding out the cast. Somehow figure a way to get James Wood in. Maybe he's like a long-lost brother or a cranky neighbor. I like that idea. We got some less serious suggestions. Tweet Stormy Daniels, Charles Barkley, do Larry Johnson, Grandmama. Oh. I mean, he's just dressing up as a woman. John and Palatine, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan and Amy, I think they should call in Ted McGinley. He replaces everybody.
Okay, thanks for the call. Good. Yeah, you could do serious casting suggestions like. Katie Sagal could reprise her role of Mary with Children.
Oh, that's right.
Here's another serious one, I think. Gary and Joliet.
Yeah. Was thinking maybe Patricia Richardson. I don't know if she's contracted to Fox, but she was on Home Improvement.
Yeah,
Home Improvement, right, with
Tim
Raymond, Allen.
Everybody Loves Raymond, and recently Malcolm in the Middle.
Malcolm
in the Middle, they just had their final season, so she's out of work.
Maybe Bryan Cranston could also play Roseanne. But, I mean, Patricia Richardson, that's sort of the character she played in Home Improvement would actually be, would translate well.
Oh, right.
Yeah, that's a good, that's a,
oh,
that's
yeah,
a
I'm issue. Mixing up. Yeah. We need a Republican, though. The person who replaces Roseanne has got to be a Republican.
How about,
because we're not represented in Hollywood ever.
How about Janine Turner? Let's go, let's graduate and go with somebody that's a little easier on the eyes than Michael Moore in drag. James in Westmont.
Quick correction, Amy. It's Patricia Heaton, and the show was The Middle. That just ended. Yeah. So I'm
Patricia Heaton from Everybody Loves Raymond, of course.
That's correct. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
Patricia Richardson's different.
Yeah, she was from.
They look alike, though, don't they?
No, they don't.
No.
Wow. Okay. Well, I guess you guys have just decided. Yeah, they totally look alike.
Stop digging. All right, James and Westmont, the floor is yours.
Yeah, thank you. I was thinking RuPaul. Why not just really go way out of the back?
Sure. All right. Thanks for the call, James. Oh. Yeah.
They already have a non-gender fluent grandchild in the show.
Oh, you think there should only be one? Bigot. I think the whole cast should be gender
fluent. I actually liked Roseanne's relationship with that grandchild because at first she was just horrified, and then she learned to love the person.
We could get Tyler from Billions.
Uh-huh. Oh.
They could play the, I don't know, Paul in Lake Forest.
I'm going along the same theme as some other people. I thought mine would be a little more unique. I was thinking Louis Anderson and drag.
All right, thanks for the call, Paul. Is Louis Anderson still alive?
Yes, he is.
All right, Louis Anderson is still alive. We're just updating Louis Anderson's condition.
Louis.
Philip in Northwest Side.
Yeah, hey, guys, good morning. We don't need a Republican in there. We don't need him destroyed in Hollywood. I can't stand the show as it is, and I can't stand Hollywood. I unplugged my old house. But if you're going to replace her, I think you should replace her with Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton needs a job. She's real good at pretending to be middle class. And, if things don't work out, they'll all support her anyway.
All right, thanks, Philip. Bob and Lyle.
Yeah, how about Robert De Niro? He's his gay lover.
John Goodman's a gay lover, and then they throw a net over him every 10 minutes. Every time he sees Trump and he goes crazy, the whole family has to hold him down.
All right, thanks, Bob. John in Naperville.
Guys, love your show. I was just driving in, and I'm thinking about Sarah Palin.
Oh.
All right. Oh, okay. Yeah, yeah. All right, thanks for the call, John.
I don't know how she'd, yeah, no.
Steve on the 88, Fran Drescher from The Nanny.
Oh,
I can talk like that.
Yeah, I missed her so much.
Hey, what did your dad text in?
I'll get to that.
She's such a tease.
Matt in Fox River Grove.
Melissa McCarthy.
Bingo.
Yeah. She'd be perfect.
Bingo.
I think she's doing, thanks for the call.
They get a mommy issues with the replacement mommy and all that, yeah.
The only problem is I think she's conflicted. I think she's working on a pilot about Sean Spicer. No?
No. All right, Larry.
My dad, I think, has, this is, again, a serious suggested change.
Of course, your dad's a very serious man. I love him because he loves cats.
That's right. He watches Two and a Half Men with his cat, and he suggests Conchata Ferrell, Berta from Two and a Half Men. Remember the maid, Berta?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That actually would be sort of a pitch-perfect fit.
Wow. Larry Proft wins the prize.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. When you've got questions, he always has an answer. It's Sean Hannity, this afternoon at 2, right before Joe Walsh at 5 on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Illinois has a notoriously severe and controversial eavesdropping law or legal regime regarding eavesdropping. For example, Christopher Drew, an artist, was arrested for selling artwork on a Chicago sidewalk in 2009 and charged with a felony recording of the incident of being arrested for selling artwork. In 2010, Bridgeport resident Michael Allison was charged with a felony for recording his own court hearing after the court did not provide a court reporter. Same year, Chicagoan Tyawanda Moore is charged with felony for recording conversations with Chicago Police Department investigators regarding her sexual misconduct complaint against an officer.
Wow.
That's because Illinois had an all-party consent.
Right.
Is an all-party consent state.
Both sides have to agree before all parties. You touch that recording.
Yeah, it's not just both sides, all parties. Federal law in a majority of states allow for one-party consent. In the March of 2014, the Supreme Court struck down Illinois' eavesdropping law, holding it criminalized a wide range of innocent conduct and violated First Amendment rights. But during the lame duck session in December of 2014, the General Assembly, in their infinite wisdom, and Pat Quinn signed a new eavesdropping law. He included changes aimed at allowing residents to record interactions with police, for example, but kept intact the all-party consent provisions and introduced a difficult-to-gauge standard for when a person must get consent for recording. Specifically, the new law made it a felony to surreptitiously record any private conversation where at least one person has a reasonable expectation of privacy. Okay, it's the Illinois Policy Institute laying out the law for us. So the case of Paul Boron, 13-year-old kid who attends Mantino Middle School, in February of this year, he's called to the principal's office after failing to attend a number of detentions, apparently. Before meeting the principal and assistant principal, he began recording audio on his cell phone. He argued with the principal and assistant principal for about 10 minutes in the reception area of the school secretary's office with a door open to the hallway. So sort of, this is important details with respect to expectation of privacy. When the young man ultimately told his assistant principal and principal he was recording, the principal told Boren he was committing a felony, ended the conversation. 2 months later, this past April, Paul Boren, 13 years old, was charged with one count of felony eavesdropping.
Oh, goodness.
So you're talking about turning this 13-year-old kid talking to and recording his principal, assistant principal, having a discussion about the detentions he did or didn't serve, and now they want to prosecute him, potentially alter his life permanently were he to be convicted of a felony.
Right. Lose his right to vote, too, right? Be hard to get a job and hard to get into college.
For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by Paul's mother, Leah McNally. Leah, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning.
So where does the case stand at present?
I don't really know. I did file an answer with the case. I ended up not being able to get to court. I also didn't have representation.
So your son does not have, you're representing your son pro se? He doesn't have an attorney?
No, I'm not allowed to. I'm assuming that they're supposed to be a public defender.
Right, okay. Yeah.
Assigned, so.
Right.
So how was your son charged? I mean, did they confront him after school? How did it go down?
No, there was just at the end of the conversation, you know, when they started harassing him more and more, you know, he finally was set up because he had tried to plead the fifth. You know, he's learning the Constitution in eighth grader, and I'm the type of mother, I try to teach him a little bit more in depth on it. And, you know, so he, at one point at the beginning, I told him he pled the fifth, and he was told that he couldn't, that he was there to discuss the charges against him.
Well, wait.
And receive his due process. And the charges were just him, the detentions is what they were talking about, the lunch detentions.
Well, so you're saying when he notified the principal and assistant principal he was recording them, then the conversation ended, then they continued interrogating him. Is that what you're saying? Are you talking about the principal and assistant principal or the police?
It's the assistant principal and the principal, but this was at the beginning of the recording. Like when he first went in there, you know, he had tried to tell them he didn't want to talk to them. He had told them this days before. And that's why he decided to record, because any time that he does state anything to them, things are twisted around and added in on his permanent school record, which he can't change. I've tried to amend some things that were on there before that he was, you know, put on there that he was falsely accused of in the past.
Why was your son called to the assistant principal's office to begin with? What's the relationship? What's the past between your son and the administration?
With this incident itself, the whole thing started. It was in the lunchroom. Him and another student were just, you know, sitting next to each other, and they were playing. They were at a table for children who were doing a good job in their classes and stuff, and they got some free time after they were finished with lunch to play on their little computers and stuff. And the other student was, you know, just playing with them, gently poking him with a pencil in a playing kind of way, you know, nothing mean or anything. And my son just simply stood up, and they were still conversing back and forth. They weren't overly loud. They weren't disturbing anyone. And the janitor came up to him and got right in his face and, you know, screamed at him, "Sit down now." My son, in the same tone that the janitor used, told him back, "No, I don't have to." And then he was like, "Well, you're going down to the office with me." My son complied. He went to the office, but he told him he did not want to speak to them. You know, he's like, "You're going to do whatever you want to do anyway, so just, you know, go ahead and do whatever you do so I can go back to class." And so they told him he had to serve lunch detentions all week long, and he didn't understand why. To him, it wasn't fair. He didn't do anything. He used the same tone of voice the janitor used. You know, if it's okay for him to do that to me, why isn't okay? Because there's an issue in the past where when he was 10, he was assaulted by and battered by a bus aide. Okay. That was all covered up to this very day. He also mentioned that while he was in the office with them, you know, "Why didn't you help me? Why didn't you help my mom?" When she was trying to, you know, go through with charges against the woman who had battered him. And they, you know, kind of just told him that was over. And that's kind of when he got a little bit more emotional and started talking a little bit more. And they didn't like what he was saying, so it was okay. Well, you know, then you can serve an out-of-school suspension or an in-school suspension, which would be across the street at the high school. He told him he wasn't going to do that. He was just going to come to class. When he told them that, they said, "Well, then you'll be arrested for trespassing at that point." And they said, "Well, you know what? Why don't you just stay home? Why don't you just not come to school at all?" That was the principal. And my son was like, "Well, why would you tell me that, especially as a principal? You're not supposed to encourage me to miss school." And then he's like, "Okay, well, you know, you have one day." And then as the conversation kind of continued for a few more minutes, it was every time he said something, it's like, "Oh, you earned yourself another day. You earned yourself another day. You earned yourself another day." And he got the 4 days out of school suspension. He's like, "You know what? That's fine." He's like, "It's all been recorded."
Oh.
And that's when the principal said, "Hey, it's wiretapping. It's a felony. This conversation's over. And then I heard nothing of it. There was no letters from the school, no letters from the juvenile, you know, center, no letters from courts.
And so ultimately in April, what happened?
I don't know. We didn't get notified. I got served, I believe it was maybe, my son got served like the 29th of May. That's when we got the official findings of it, and I was supposed to have court June 5th.
But you got notice that he is being charged with a felony, and you're to appear in court June 5th.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it was just by a sheriff serving the paperwork.
Have you spoken with the principal and assistant principal about this, or what have your previous interactions been with them about your son?
I haven't spoken with them to this. After the bus incident, I just had more and more escalations through the school system with the different issues with my children, and I'm one of those parents, I speak up for my children. You know, if something is not right, it's not right. If they do something wrong, then, you know, they need to adhere to the disciplinary actions, whether it be at home, at school, wherever. You know, you respect other people when you're around them and respect yourself. But throughout the years, they've had this thing with me where they don't like to talk and discuss things because they kind of put their foot in their mouth, and they decided that the only way they would contact me was through email because they watch what they say that way.
Well, it's good to have a paper trail.
And when he asked them at first to please, you know, call my mom before I talk to you, they obviously refused, and that's...
And your son is 13 years old, or was he 12 years old at the time?
He was 13. He'll be 14 next month.
So have you seen the recording, and does the recording make the assistant principal look bad?
Yeah, more so the principal than the assistant principal, because he's the principal is the more aggressive one to the students. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's definitely not a conversation. It's not the way you should be talking to a child, especially as a person who's in charge and supposed to be showing them how they're supposed to handle situations and how they're supposed to respond to people correctly and politely. And
do you have other children in the school?
Yes, sir. I have 5 children altogether. My oldest daughter, she just graduated last year, and then I have my 4 boys that were in this year.
Were there incidents in the school with this administration with your other children as well?
Oh, yes. Yes. With the same middle school, the thing that made me pull my youngest son out, he's ADHD and he has an impulse disorder, and the teachers, like, they didn't put him on, like, a 504 plan or the IEP for some reason. They age them out once they get out of elementary school on the disability stuff, or at least they did with my child. And he was in the hallway, and the teacher put him in the hallway for him acting out in class, and she left him unattended, and the assistant principal tried to make light with me as if it was a funny thing that he had, you know, wandered 33 feet down the hallway, and the assistant principal was only 2 feet off about how far it was from the door to the water fountain. I'm like, well, what would happen if my child decided, hey, I don't want to be in here anymore, I'm just going to walk out the door? Like, how long would it have took you guys to notice that?
Is there something going on at the school? I mean, are there other parents and who have similar complaints in terms of how their children have been treated by the principal or assistant principal or the combination of the two? I mean, is there something going on at the school, or is it specific to your family?
No, there's definitely other kids affected by it in the area. It's kind of hard because I don't know, like, as far as, you know.
But you've spoken.
Putting the stuff out there, there are issues with other families.
You've spoken to other families that have kids in the school.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Is your son going to be returning to the same school this fall?
Not if the same administrators are there, no. I don't feel that their physical safety and emotional safety is any part of their concern, and I feel like they'd be abused even further and way more serious.
Well,
now, because any time I've spoken up, there's been retaliation.
I mean, it's, you know, the law notwithstanding, it's I find it rather remarkable that a principal and assistant principal would move to see a 13-year-old charged with felony over recording a phone conversation. Have you spoken with the Kankakee County State's Attorney's Office, and have they communicated with you at all about this case, about wanting to plead him out or right. Yes, exactly.
No, I have a hard time communicating with anybody in this county due to the fact, like I said, I've spoken up in the past and that tends to be frowned upon. Especially with the last incident where when he was 10, when he was defending himself from the bus aide, when I tried to press charges, they immediately attempted to charge him with a battery against her. And they let that linger for a little over a year before they decided to drop it due to self-defense, yet they no charged her.
When is his case next due to come up in court?
I don't know. I'll be finding out Monday. I have to go into the court physically with my ID to find out. You know, I understand they don't want to give you information of a minor over the phone in case you're not who you're claiming to be. So,
mm-hmm. Are you? Is your son? Is Paul still in school? Is he going to that middle school, Mantino?
No, I pulled them all out right after that incident. That was, you know, a little bit too much to keep handling, especially with my youngest one, with what they had done with him and having him in the office, and that same principal trying to pin him in the doorway, and he pushed himself backwards where his rear end was pinning like up against my child and like pinning him in between the doorway, trying to get him to stay into the office because he didn't want to stay in there and talk. They're not good with talking to children. I think child development classes should be maybe implemented if they're not taking them. I don't know where it's going awry, where they're not connecting with children and understanding that when a child has had something happen to them where they were physically harmed, then they're still having a hard time dealing with it emotionally, and why you would just continue to attack them over it. Like, seems to be like a power struggle with them.
Can I make a recommendation to you, friendly recommendation? With respect to the legal representation of your son, you need to make sure that he has legal representation here, because this is not a commentary on the Kankakee County State's Attorney's Office, but the law is the law, and they may be a little bit hamstrung. Relying on a public defender, relying on the good intentions of everybody, particularly when I think there's certainly at least question about the intentions of the school administrators who are going to have some standing in the eyes of the court, you need to make sure that your son has proper representation so that he is not, frankly, in my judgment, inappropriately convicted of a felony at 13 years old. Obviously, that would be a catastrophic outcome, and it seems wholly unwarranted based on the facts as you've laid them out.
Yes, and that's the same way I felt. I was actually just completely shocked that they had took it to that level. I mean, they have in the past with stuff threatened, you know, with charges, and, you know, they tried to do the same thing with my older son in high school when he was jumped by another student, you know, who had been saying racial stuff to him and harassing him. And I attempted to go to the police, the local police department, and they told me that I had to wait. And they contacted the principal there to make sure he was okay with me pressing charges. And then when they got here, they were trying to talk me out of it, and tried to threaten him with, you know, saying that he committed a felony when he was on the floor and trying to defend himself as the child was then over him after he punched him from behind on the side of the face and grabbed him by his neck and body slammed him on the floor. It's an intimidation tactic. So when it actually went through to the court system, it was very shocking.
Well, I'll tell you what, off air, I'll get you some information, a referral, some people that may be able to help you in this case pro bono so that you're on a level playing field with the state and the school, so to speak, because this seems a bit silly to me. So Leah McNally.
I appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem. Leah McNally, the mom of Paul Boren, Mantino Middle School kid, being charged with felony eavesdropping for recording a conversation between himself and the principal and assistant principal of his middle school. Leah, hold on, and we'll get right to you, okay?
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, as the Supreme Court's term comes to an end, some of the bigger cases are being, with the opinions of the bigger cases are being released. And yesterday it was South Dakota v. Wayfair. A 5-4 majority tossed out the court's 50-year physical presence standard that limited states from collecting sales tax from out-of-state retailers, providing the opportunity for states to require internet retailers to collect sales taxes from customers
that live in states that don't have sales tax, right?
Well, that live in states where the retailer has no physical presence.
Ah, got it.
And it was interesting, the majority, it's sort of an unusual coalition, Clarence Thomas, yeah. Gorsuch, Alito, Ginsburg, and Kennedy form the majority. Justice Kennedy writing the opinion for the majority, arguing that the physical presence rule, is a poor proxy for the compliance costs faced by companies that do business in multiple states, and suggesting that other aspects of the Commerce Clause can better and more accurately address any potential burdens on interstate commerce. The holding provides the opportunity for states to perhaps have a go-ahead to tax other kinds of online commerce, such as media downloads and streaming services, as we do here with the cloud tax in Chicago, but limited here. This so has implications for poorly run states that have huge unfunded liabilities and debt loads, like, say, Illinois, Connecticut, New Jersey, California, New York, to become a lot more creative as it pertains to taxing business. You can imagine how this is being received in the community of free marketeers who want the internet to be held as inviolate as possible. If we want to normalize the playing field between the internet and brick and mortar stores, let's move in the direction of reducing taxes on everybody as opposed to imposing taxes on everyone. And for more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined by one of the leaders of that chorus. He is our friend Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform. Grover, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Dan, Amy, good to be with you.
You say in the statement you released following the announcement of the court's decision that today the Supreme Court said, yes, you can be taxed by politicians you do not elect and who act knowing you are powerless to object. What do you mean?
Well, this legalizes taxation without representation. What physical presence was, L.L. Bean used to just have one store in Maine, but they'd sell you stuff over catalogs, through the mail, through the internet. And if you bought a shirt in Maine, you would pay the sales tax because all their staff is there, their business is there, they use the fire department, their people go to school. But if you bought it online or through the mail on catalogs from Illinois, there's nothing in L.L. Bean that uses any of the services of any city in Illinois or the state. And if Illinois wanted to tax you because you live in Illinois, they could knock on your door and say you owe us some money. But Illinois said it's easier for us to levy taxes on these businesses and make them do our cool. And the Supreme Court said with 10,000 taxing jurisdictions, this is years ago, with 10,000 taxing jurisdictions, there's no way in the world that even large companies could do this very competently, but certainly a small company that's, you know, making stuff and shipping it around to a few hundred people or a few thousand people, and they've got to keep the records on that. It's way too abusive. Only physical presence. You can tax businesses when they set a store up in your state, but not if there's no physical presence from the store. You can always tax the person. They can always do that. So politicians want to be able to levy the tax on the business, not on you, because I don't want to irritate you, because you can vote against them. So they want the sales tax to be paid by somebody else. This is all about, from the standpoint of the politicians, let's make it easy to get our money. Let's fool people as to who's raising. Oh, L.L. Bean's raising their prices. No, they're not. Illinois is raising their taxes. And they've opened a Pandora's box. Well, because this is not about sales taxes. It never was. What the left wants to do, what the public employee unions want, is to extend the income tax, the personal and corporate business income tax, across state lines. That's where the cash is. There is no money on sales tax. Now that Amazon's on, in all 50 states, right? Right. They're already paying this tax.
Well, what does it mean? Okay,
they're
so
one or two.
All right, sorry for interrupting here, but what does it mean? There's four states with no sales tax: Delaware, Montana, Oregon, New Hampshire. So how does that work? If you live in a state that has no sales tax, you order something from a different state, are you taxed with that? How is it going to work? I don't get it.
Lord knows how it's going to work because we haven't now a state that has a sales tax and a use tax, right? I mean, it's a crime for you to use something you bought somewhere else without paying Illinois. The use tax, it's like a sales tax, but they have to admit that you may have bought it somewhere else. The state of Illinois wants to make a state that has no sales tax and businesses that don't collect sales taxes because they don't have sales taxes in Delaware and some of these states.
Right.
They're going to have to do something to collect Illinois' tax. And by the way, they're going to get a letter from Illinois. Here's how we do it. Do it our way. They'll get one from Texas. Here's how we do it. Do it our way. There are 50 different states, okay? And Illinois is not the only crazy one. So they're going to, and cities will weigh in, and counties will weigh in, and the water districts will figure out a way to get in on this action.
But to the point that Anthony Kennedy said, essentially, this has been a tax shelter for retailers. That's not exactly true because they're not paying the taxes. They're collecting the taxes under this decision. And the argument that's made is in all 45 states with sales taxes, residents owe the tax on all purchases they make, whether they're filling their shopping cart at a bricks and mortar store or ordering from a website of a distant retailer. So if the taxes aren't collected at the point of sale, the shopper has to pay them when he or she files his annual tax return. But states don't have an effective way of enforcing this. So this is a way to narrowly address this. If the court were, if the court's mind was to narrowly address the scenario I just described, thinking that they're opening this Pandora's box that you're describing of where the left wants to go next, where the tax eaters want to go next, do you have a problem with addressing this problem that they've identified?
Well, first of all, I saw the numbers you said. It may be $33 billion. This is a nonsense number that the left has been putting out for 20 years, okay? And the number they put out never changes, which always makes me wonder about a number that hasn't changed in 20 years.
okay.
The amount, the major companies have presences in all 50 states. And so Amazon, you know, hanging out in Oregon or Washington and shipping stuff out, that doesn't happen. That's not what's going on. In almost all cases, except diamonds, the cost of shipping books or anything else from one state to your state is more than the sales tax you avoid by buying it online, okay? So this cost differential that some businesses tell you, oh, there's this big cost differential because they'll come into my bookstore, not buy my books, they'll order them online. The cost of shipping is greater than the cost of the sales tax. This is what people are using online or catalogs before online for convenience and because it's easier for them to do. I realize retailers are having challenges. They're blaming everybody and their brother other than themselves. Their big cities need more money. They want to imagine there's a way to get it from somebody who can't vote against them and that there's billions and billions of dollars. It's just not accurate. When you look at the numbers, they're much smaller than that. And what we will get eventually is a law out of Washington, D.C.,
right.
And, you know, it's a sad situation when a lot of Washington, D.C. is what's going to improve the chaos, is to say, hopefully, you know, smaller businesses don't get whacked like this and put some limits. I mean, a state could send a note to a business and note to L.L. Bean, just for example, and say, we think you owe us $1,000 in sales taxes you haven't paid. Either send us $1,000 or spend about $10,000 on a lawyer. Make a decision quick. Okay. And you could abuse an out-of-state smaller business. Why? Because they can't vote against you. And they'll just send you the money. And it's probably a good idea to raise money for your next campaign from those people, too, while they're looking at those, the amount of corruption and abuse of what you can do to somebody in a state that does where they can't vote against you, there's no limit to how nasty you can be to people who won't vote against you.
And so we can distinguish this from, say, other taxation this, we moved from a physical nexus test with retailers, online retailers, to this economic presence test. And thinking about how states do income tax taxation, if I'm physically present in Florida for 181 days as opposed to Illinois, then I can file my income taxes, which I don't have to because there's no income tax in Florida, which, of course, is what a lot of Illinoisans are doing. But if I'm not, if I'm in Illinois a majority of the year, then I have to file here. So when it comes to the individual or the business, there is the brick and mortar business, there's still this physical presence standard. And now we're going to sort of an physical nexus, physical presence. Now we're going to an economic presence test, you know, that's virtual. And so is this the argument to make? And this the differential that Congress needs to address?
Yeah, well, they're going to decide that they can export corporate income taxes. The Europeans have already announced that they want to tax companies that make money based off of eyeballs in Europe. Okay, that's the presence that people are going online and doing stuff, and companies. They've looked at some of our larger, most successful companies. They can't compete with that. They can't do that themselves, and they want to tax it. And they're coming up with new theories of how do you say that somebody owes you money because somehow they did what inside your borders. Our Supreme Court has just told the Europeans, you can be very inventive. The simple one is, are you physically here, which stops a lot of nonsense. We've thrown that out the window. Did we offer something else? No. Is there a federal standard? No. We're going to have 50 states making their own standards. We're going to have 1,000 cities making their own standards. It's going to get ugly and crazy, and eventually Congress will come in. And imagine what hostage the Democrats will demand to fix this, right? They'll go to the retailers and say, well, we can fix your problem for you. And they go to consumers, we can fix your problem for you. But you're going to have to do X.
Yeah.
And that is going to be expensive. We have been fighting in Congress to keep Congress from making it worse than it was when we had the Supreme Court protection of physical presence. The fight has not been to get this fixed. The fight has been to avoid having it get worse. And because the big city political machines are desperate for more cash, and they will fight against anything that limits the ability of cities. I don't care so much about states, of cities being able to export these taxes. And then hopefully the state will export some and give it to the cities.
He is Grover Norquist, president of Americans for Tax Reform. Grover, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Dan, Amy, thanks.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, Joe Walsh here. This immigration hell week comes to a close. Where are we? We'll talk about that when freedom returns at 5.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. And so this Honduran 2-year-old girl, Yanela Hernandez.
Oh, yeah, she's everywhere. She's like the face of this event, or whatever you want to call it.
Sure.
Crisis, whatever.
D.C. press corps outlets and their allied handmaidens in places like Chicago picked up on this girl who was crying, so made her the face of the family separation issue.
Right. They actually have her on the cover of Time magazine. They photoshopped President Trump in looking down at her with Welcome to America.
Mm-hmm. All right. Imposing, like, Welcome to America.
Yes.
You're not coming in. She's crying. Scott Stantis, a sentimentalist cartoonist for the Tribune, picked up on this. Everybody was reporting this story and reporting it inaccurately. The father of the 2-year-old child, said that she was never separated from her mom. His daughter was never separated from her mother.
Oh, really?
Never separated.
But that doesn't fit the narrative. I mean, the first time I saw this video, she was with her mom, and she just started crying because her mom was being questioned. But also, she's 2, and 2-year-olds cry a lot when they're hungry or tired, and look like she had just had a long journey.
The father, Dennis, said his wife and daughter were never separated by Border Control agents and remain together. His wife previously mentioned her wish to go to the United States for a better future, but did not tell him or any of their family members that she was planning to make the trek. She paid a coyote $6,000 to help her and the daughter get across the border. I didn't support it. I asked her why. Why would she want to put our little girl through that? But it was her decision at the end of the day, said Dennis, the father slash husband. He said his wife wanted to experience the American dream, hoped to find a good job in the States, whereas he works as a captain at a port on the coast of Puerto Cortez, explaining things at home were fine but not great, and his wife was seeking political asylum, so she made the decision to make the 1,800-mile journey with her two-year-old daughter on June 3rd and with the help of a coyote, and he hadn't heard from her since. But all that happened was she put the child down.
Right.
The child started crying. A Getty photographer snapped the picture, and then they built the narrative around it.
I mean, she was just if you see the whole video in its entirety, you can clearly see it was taken out of context.
I'll look forward to all of those corrections being issued.
Oh, right.
For more on this topic, writ large, we're pleased to be joined by Steve Cortez, CNN political commentator and Trump Hispanic Advisory Council member. Steve got in a bit of a sticky wicket on CNN this week because he used language that is not officially sanctioned by CNN, calling the people trying to get into this country illegally invaders, not immigrants. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Thanks for having me.
So this incendiary language you're using, you're upsetting your fellow panelists at CNN. Explain yourself.
You know, I did. Just to clarify, though, I did put out a tweet the next day, and I actually said I wished I hadn't used that word. I mean, I think it's technically true, but I don't want to fall into the same trap that the left constantly uses against us. I don't want to succumb to their incendiary language where they always use the most hyperbolic terms possible. In this case, constantly comparing us to Nazis, which is just utterly insulting, illogical, you know, on every level wrong. And I don't want to even go a little bit down that path. So I do take back the term invader, but nonetheless, I'm not softening on policy. I still think anyone who trespasses over our sovereign border without permission needs to be prosecuted. And if they happen to have a child in tow with them, that's a tragedy for the child, and the child's a victim of their parents' misbehavior, or a lot of times it's not the parent, but the adult's misbehavior, because half the time we don't know who these people are. So I haven't softened it all on my stance, and certainly on the policy, but I'm going to try to use more appropriate words because, again, I don't want to do what General Hayden, former head of the CIA, did when he compared this to Auschwitz.
No, you shouldn't do that.
Donnie Deutsch just this morning on MSNBC said anyone who supports this policy is effectively a Nazi guard. He said that on Morning Joe. So their language is so over the top that I don't even want to get within the arena of that. So I'll take back invaders, but I stand firm on the policy of we need zero tolerance border control.
Well, speaking of taking back, were you taken back by President Trump's rare reversal in this executive order that he signed?
I was very taken back, quite frankly. And I said so on air. I don't often criticize the president, but I thought that was I thought the message he sent was, if you call me Hitler 5,000 times, I might cave, right? Or if you show some disturbing pictures. And by the way, I'm so glad that you talked about the truth of that crying toddler. By the way, I've got four kids. If we were to base policy on kids crying, even family policy, that would be a mistake, much less national policy. Now, look, are there some kids down there who are having a tough time? I'm sure, and I empathize tremendously. They are victims. They didn't choose to do this. Just as any criminal in the United States who's separated from their child probably is causing anguish for the child. But, you know, that doesn't mean the cop who arrested them is the perpetrator. It doesn't mean President Trump is the perpetrator. It means their parents who decided willfully to break the law. They are the ones who are mistreating those children. And look, I really believe that the president, I think, temporarily succumbed to weakness there. I really do. However, on the other side, this morning he's putting out some pretty tough tweets. And if anything, he seems to be moving back to the right of telling the Congress, for instance, in his tweet this morning, don't bother. You know, and I think what he means by that is I'm not going to sign some sort of milquetoast, watered down Paul Ryan amnesty bill. And I think maybe he's finding his spine again. And hopefully some people like me who were disappointed with him and told him so on air and otherwise after that executive order, maybe we reaffirmed his his strength on this issue.
Do you think that's a little bit of an effort to apply some reverse psychology to Senate Democrats in particular, if the Paul Ryan bill were to make it out of the House next week and be taken up by the Senate? The president has previously said he would sign either bill, the Ryan bill or the Goodlatte bill. The Goodlatte bill loses yesterday, goes down, doesn't pass. But maybe trying to get to just keep Democrats in that crucible. If you say you want a solution writ large, well, here's a solution, including a DACA fix, including a family separation fix. And if you can get it over to the Senate, I'll continue to be open-minded about signing it if it gets to my desk. And if it doesn't get to my desk, it highlights Democrats' complete uninterest in actually addressing immigration in any material way.
Right. No, and that could well be his strategy there. And by the way, that is just the reality of the situation. You know, the president came a long way. For a man who campaigned on no DACA, right? He promised to end DACA on day one of his presidency, which, by the way, I don't agree with him on that point. I'm pro DACA. But the point is, he went from saying no DACA day one, it's done, all the way over to, you know, extending it as president and then offering, I think, a really, really generous solution. I mean, not only is he offering DACA, he's offering almost three times the number of people that signed up for it. About 750,000 or so signed up. He's offering all the way to 2 million who we believe are eligible for it. So he went, I think, you know, above and beyond expectations, really got a lot of people in his base pretty angry, frankly, but said, I'm willing to make this amnesty. And there's no other word for it. It's an amnesty. I'm willing to make this amnesty if we get the border wall, restrictions on chain migration, and to be the lottery. And now we're also thrown into that soup, you know, clarifying this issue of separating families. So, to me, he bent over backwards, and the Democrats still said, you know, we're not coming to the table.
Well,
we're not playing ball.
There.
What does that tell me? They want an issue. They don't want a solution. They want to show crying babies in November because they think it'll allow them to take the House.
So they're pushing the vote on this, you know, moderate immigration plan to next week. But yesterday, there no Democrats even voted. They didn't. I mean, it's like they're ignoring its existence.
Right. No, there's a standoff. I mean, I think it's ridiculous. Again, the Democrats want an issue. Let's just be honest here, too, I think, about immigration. I give President Trump so much credit for taking this issue head on, because for decades, Republicans sort of talked tough on controlling the border and illegal immigration, but they never acted. And I think the reason they didn't is because their corporate clients, their crony capitalist clients, frankly, love the constant flow of cheap labor into this country. And so that's the fault sort of on the right. And then on the left, all they saw is new voters. Right, is people who will come here, some of whom will illegally vote, but they'll have children who will be American citizens who will vote, and that's all they saw was we want to grow the Democratic Latino base in places like Texas and California, and so I think both sides, frankly, neglected the interests of the American worker and instead pursued their very narrow parochial political interests. Trump came in and smashed that and just said you're all wrong. The swamp has this wrong, and the American people don't want uncontrolled illegal immigration because it's a risk to national security, and it's most of all for them, for most of them, it's a risk to economic security. And so I give him credit for blowing that system up, but it's not easy to go in there and blow it up. And so that's what we're seeing now is, you know, a lot of fits and starts on the road to I think sanity of controlling illegal immigration.
You're a bit of a raconteur, a fashion plate. So I wonder if you could comment on the greater fashion emergency yesterday. Was it Wendell Carter Jr.'s Gucci scarf or Melania's I Really Don't Care, Do You coat?
Right. Well, you know, I really don't know what the message was with the coat. What do you think, Dan?
I think it was scrunched up so much. I mean, you're asking Dan, but I'm inserting myself.
Yeah,
I think because I'm the woman here. I think it was scrunched up so much you couldn't read what it said. So the media had to find, you know, a copy of what that jacket was to see what it said.
Right.
And I was shocked.
I think that
the whole world's watching. She can wear anything. She's a billionaire fashion model. She chooses last year's Zara, which is a $39 jacket.
It is still au courant. But I think what you're missing, I think, you know, both of them are sort of very good at manipulating the media. I think they're provocateurs. Her, obviously, much more subtle than President Trump. And I think they like to put things out there that leave people discussing them, trying to interpret them, seeing, you know, sort of inscrutably trying to, you know, divine meaning from every move or every article of clothing that is offered for public consumption. And I think so. Yeah, I think you could interpret it a lot of different ways, and I think they like that.
Right. No, listen, that's true. And I'll tell you one thing that Trump has certainly done since he ran for office and certainly now as president is he always figures out ways, and I think sometimes very purposely so, to absolutely dominate the conversation. I mean, if you watch the cable news channels, 95% of the day is directly Trump-related, and he wants it that way, I think. If he sucks up all the oxygen in the room, you know, that's a good thing for Trump. And in general, it has worked for him. There's times when it doesn't, but in general. I do think, by the way, too, on the substance of it, I'm very glad that she went down there because there are kids suffering, and so I think it was the right human thing to do. I also think it was smart politically. Let's, you know, we've got a lot of bad pictures that people show, some of which are dishonest, like that Time cover, but there are some, you know, some troubling pictures. Let's show a great picture, you know, of our beautiful First Lady, mother, you know, going down there and showing compassion. I think the president himself should go, and I've told the White House that. I think he should go and tour one of these camps and just make sure, put his own eyes on it and see that kids are being well-treated. You know, because, again, I think it's the right human thing to do, but also the optics and the politics matter. But, again, I can't emphasize enough, these kids, if there are kids who are in traumatic experiences, it's because of what their parents did, not right. because of what President Trump did or ICE or Border Patrol.
He is Steve Cortez, CNN political commentator and member of Trump's Hispanic Advisory Council. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
You bet. Have a great day.
He joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and obviously we want to remark upon the passing of the great Charles Krauthammer yesterday. Good op-ed from a friend of his. In the Wall Street Journal, Erwin Stelzer, who works at the Hudson Institute, and he remembers Krauthammer, the man. Charles often traveled to speak at fundraisers for charities important to his colleagues. When in some city to give a speech, he always found time to meet one-on-one with veterans whose spinal injuries would leave them wheelchair-bound for life. He said Charles didn't take himself too seriously. His humor, more often than not, was self-deprecating. When aimed at others, it was gentle, unhurtful, designed to persuade the target to have a second thought, and I thought it was nice yesterday, the Washington Nationals, he's a huge baseball fan,
right.
had a moment of silence at the game.
Oh, that's wonderful. And, of course, he leaves just a lot of heavy hearts on both sides. Liberals alike are just saying what a great, brilliant man he was. And his works will live on forever, and it will influence the American culture forever. Because actually, there was no one like Charles Krauthammer.
Had the opportunity to talk to him a few years ago when I was at a different station when his book, The Things That Matter, came out. And, you know, he's just one of those guys that's just a different kind of conversation. And even last year before he took ill, we would regularly use his insights on this show. I mean, just for example, talking about Comey. Think about that.
Look, it looks awful. Normally you give immunity so that you can prosecute. You may lose the case, but at least there's not even a prosecution. The impression left is, and we probably will never know, it was understood, not said, not written, not emailed, but it was understood we were not going to indict the Democratic candidate for the presidency.
And, I mean, that's essentially what the IG's report released last week concluded. Without saying it, the fix was in. Krauthammer saw it a year ago.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.